You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on the 23rd of January 2016 on Monocle 24. From Milan to Paris and New York too, the world's most stylish cities are lighting up as 2016's premier fashion events take hold. But it's in the pages of the world's best fashion magazines that we get a hint of what's to come in the seasons ahead. So where does the market sit as we head on into 2016? That's today on The Stack. Coming up on today's programme, from the industry staples to the doyens of consumer fashion, we're peeling back the cover of fashion publishing.
It seems to be the season of the relaunch in Tokyo at the moment. There's a number of magazines which have gone through a bit of an overhaul.
Plus, as a pioneering Australian title bids farewell, we'll consider what makes the modern fashion magazine and ask why some fail to make the cut.
It's like any other industry to a certain degree. You know, the good titles, the good things don't go away.
We're delving into the fashion pages today on The Stack, Monocle 24's dedicated print industry review and analysis programme. Hello and welcome to The Stack with me, Tom Edwards. It is, of course, that time of the year when the world's most stylish cities are descended upon by the fashion industry elite. So we're spending today delving into the fashion pages and taking the temperature on what makes the best modern magazine. We'll get the thoughts of Sagra Masira de Rosen a little later in the show. First, however, let's welcome two very familiar voices to The Stack. Monocle's editor, Andrew Tuck, is here with me in London. And from Tokyo, your usual host and Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé. Tyler, hello. Good to speak with you as always. I mean, it's a good place to start, I guess, where you're sat right now when we talk about fashion titles. What's jumped out at you at the newsstand where you are in sort of the height of fashion season? A few old favourites, something new perhaps?
Konnichiwa, gentlemen. Tom, there's been a lot of chat in the office right now because it seems to be the season of the relaunch in Tokyo. At the moment, there's a number of magazines which have gone through a bit of an overhaul. So two titles that people would be quite familiar with. We talk about them from time to time on this program. They certainly do the rounds in our building. I think people are always asking the Tokyo Bureau, can you please send copies of either Hanako or Kunel to London? And I know that our photo desk and the fashion team and I think obviously people who are just interested in a good grid and good design are interested in both of these titles. Now, a couple of months ago, we did a story on Magazine House, one of the big publishers in the fashion design and lifestyle arena in Japan. And what's interesting is these are two quite niche titles. Hanako is a magazine which is really devoted to the Tokyo girl. It's very much focused on a certain young woman, probably late 20s, early 30s, professional. It's quite famous because the Australian graphic designer Ken Doan designed the cover. And it has this nice immediacy. It's always been stapled, and it's incredibly dense. It always does these very sort of, you know, deep pieces on great neighborhoods, where to find the best muffin, where to find the best tummy warmer, all of these sort of little quirks of Tokyo. Anyway, it's been relaunched. Out go the staples. It's perfect bound. It's become a little bit more slick. And so the jury is out on that one. And Kunel, which is a very sort of quirky magazine, and they can just spend page after page looking at smock dresses made in a distant corner of Kyushu. There's always, they might just go to the Ukraine and do a piece on ceramics. Well, that's also relaunched, larger format, and is very much targeting, I would say, the Japanese woman 60 plus. But the Japanese woman 60 plus who has not given up on life. Of course, Japan has a number of good magazines doing this, but it seems a little bit more mass. So that's the report. It's not all good news. Two much-loved titles that have gone for a bit of a refresh, but maybe not in the right direction.
Interesting, though, Tyler, particularly you pick up on that idea of these sort of niche titles, looking at very specific corners of the market. And Andrew, I guess looking at the world of fashion titles as a whole, it's quite interesting, going back even, a generation or two, the magazines were kind of one of the main conduits between the very sort of industry, the B2B events, the big fashion shows, and then the consumer. And they played a critical role in bringing that betwixt and between. Do you think that the role of the fashion title more broadly has kind of changed? Because now people have so many more ways to access that information. They're a bit more consumer facing.
Yeah. So if you were the editor of a Vogue or even a fashion editor of a small magazine, you had a kind of access that other people didn't have. You went to the shows. They were exclusive events. There was a door that was shut. You were shown clothes. People were told not to get their cameras out unless they were from the press. People were scared of espionage. These days, lots of brands have decided, okay, let's stream live our events and let everybody around the world watch them online. Let's invite in every blogger that you can think of and let's get this story out there immediately. It means that even some of the ways that the collections are being done now, it's not so seasonal. People are thinking more trans-seasonal, which is one of those buzzwords, or people are thinking, see it on the catwalk today in some extreme examples, place your order at the end of the day and we will start shipping it in a couple of weeks. So the relationship, the immediacy. And I think what's interesting is happening is it's probably, oddly, the fashion world has been hit in the same way as the newspaper world. So that immediate news, that what happened today, what happened to me, we've just come out of the shows, we had our team in Milan. But actually, if you went online, you could see a huge amount. But what then becomes important is the discerning voice. So of course, you can see the looks and all those things. And what it forces the fashion magazines to do is to do the deeper analysis, just as newspapers did. Who are the players that are going to change the field? So in some ways, I think it's forced the big fashion magazines to do a little bit better reporting here and there. But you've kind of, what you used to see, after every season, you'd see these amazing kind of like books attached to every magazine, which was like, everybody dressed in white, plaids back, big bows in your hair, please. And that kind of print world has really diminished.
Andrew misses the era of the big bow.
But I do want to know where to get that muffin. That's for sure. I want to come and get that muffin after the show.
Andrew, you didn't come to Milan last week. And this is one of the amazing things. I thought it was a crowd of people who might have shown up because maybe, I don't know what your Instagram feed looks like. But there were about 700 people packed outside the Park Hyatt. And there were barricades. Now, if I ask you, does the name Cameron Dallas mean anything to either of you?
I'm afraid not.
Neither okay, to
well,
me.
There you go. So here is the point that, and I think you sort of hit it on the head that everything has shifted so much. And so I went into the hotel and I thought, well, probably Justin Bieber is here, someone like that, some big name that you would think is going to be there front row or is going to be first out down the catwalk for one of the big brands. Someone like Justin Bieber is going to be at Dolce & Gabbana. So I went into the bar at the hotel. This is where we always do our event. I asked the chief bartender. I said, who's staying in the hotel? He's like, he goes, no idea. Never heard of them. I said, well, singer, performer. He goes, I don't know. He goes. I think he writes something on the internet. and so then we asked different people. They said, oh yeah, it's this. He's got a name like a hotel, a city in Texas, Dallas, Cameron Dallas. So of course we had to go look this person up. He's got a following, one of the biggest followings, in the bloggo Twitter sphere, millions and millions of people. Not one of the girls out front had anything to do with the world of menswear. So there wasn't like one guy lined up. So this was quite interesting. It was all sort of young girls clearly following this person, not consumers. Maybe they're going to go to Calvin Klein or somewhere and buy a fragrance or buy panties. I don't know. But what was interesting as well is you can see that these big brands are absolutely trying to cash in on this immediacy with people that none of us, well, at least these three people assembled in two studios on the other side of the world have never heard of.
And I think that's a question me and Tyler have asked ourselves many times as you go around the world. Sometimes when you're, especially in Asia, where many of these bloggers have a huge following, you can go to a fashion store, one of the very big brands from Europe, and the shop is full of people looking, but they're there for kind of like Saturday, Sunday entertainment. They go to the mall to walk through all the luxury stores, but are they kind of purchasing? It's the same debate around newspapers. These brands are getting very good at creating a lot of noise. It's not clear in all instances that how they're then converting that kind of that other type of media buzz that's not in print into cash sales. Whereas we know in print, there is still a relationship between seeing, an amazing shoot, a good piece of advertising that is very motivational between, you know, the woman who has the money to buy a magazine thinking, I will go and spend $X hundred, €X hundred on that coat, that jacket.
So Tyler, what's the secret then for fashion coverage in magazines, whether it's explicitly fashion titles or magazine, maybe like Monocle that does fashion well? What's the secret as we're facing the sorts of transitions that you and Andrew have been describing there?
Well, I think part of it is legitimacy, and as Andrew was saying, that of course, it comes down to the analysis. It comes down to a point of view. Yes, you can see every single collection is pretty much going to be thrown up there right away for the world to look at. But has someone really said, well, these people are on brand or on trend for the season, or it's great that they seem to have sort of turned off and gone a different direction. So I think that that is the role of a good fashion editor, someone who's going to go and snoop around and really discover those interesting brands, and that's what we try to do. But I think the big problem facing the glossy world right now is it comes back to not just legitimacy, but it comes back to impartiality. And some people sort of might laugh at that term in fashion, but we Net-a-Porter with Porter magazine has really changed things. This has become it's a glossy, looks a lot like Vogue, but in many ways it is a catalog dressed up as something else. Now we see Condé Nast also moving into this space. So I think there's going to be a real challenge on the part of traditional magazines right now. When are you well and truly selling to me, but is it transparent that you're selling to me? Because I'm a click away from a transaction. Is that product there because somehow you've hedged on it and you've bought a 100 pair of those jeans because you think you're going to shift a lot of them? And I think that is a big issue right now as we see this migration towards more e-commerce, more of the big glossies moving towards retail. I think that there's going to be at least a level of confusion, or I think a lot of consumers are going to be asking, am I being duped or not right now? And I think, a title like ours, I think we have to be sort of, very clear that we are putting in the hours, we're going up and down those aisles. And of course, we have a number of big advertisers, but it doesn't necessarily mean that Daphne or Jamie or Chiara or whoever is at the shows, is going to feature that and it's going to land on our pages.
And I think that's Tyler's making a fascinating point. This is the transition of many of these, actually amazing old school titles into shopping catalogs. Now, they're doing that in part because they've seen the likes of, Porter magazine coming along from Net-a-Porter, a kind of a glossy representation of a website for buying clothes. It's done in a more elevated way than that. But all of these magazine brands are thinking, how do we play a part in that as well? Because if we manage to shift clothes, then we have another revenue stream. There's that hideous idea a few years ago that every page would have a QR code on it, and then you just go and order. That kind of has thankfully kind of gone away. But this notion of being shopping magazines is at the forefront of the debate. But then the interesting thing is, that world of, who is the arbiter of what is kind of beauty? And let's not get too carried away, but, designer like Dior or Heidi Slimane at their time have probably said something interesting about culture in a way. Their clothes are saying, and that's the bit of interpretation that then gets lost. If everything becomes about shopping and bloggers and just shifting goods, there's no kind of there's no setup in a way. It's all just about the kind of the end product. And that is the bit that will get lost.
And Tyler, maybe just a final thought. What about some of the other changes we've seen in terms of the fashion media marketplace? You think of an institution, I don't know, maybe like Women's Wear Daily, which has obviously gone through a number of evolutions recently. Is it tempting but a mistake to look at what's happened to certain specific titles and make a conclusion about what that says about the whole market?
Well, I think that so much of it feeds off of each other, and I think we've been flip-flopping in this discussion, referencing newspapers and what's happening there, and fashion, and we see so many of the big players right now are looking, and I'm saying big players being big media companies, are looking at their overall portfolio of titles, and of course many of them realize that they still need to be in print, but are having a good hard look, saying, is this magazine well and truly on a downward spiral? Do we get out while we can, because we will use those funds to invest more in digital, or maybe we're going to go and launch a new title. So no question, we're in a period of rationalization right now. Of course, a number of big companies looking at shuttering some very significant, and then many would say also hallmark brands for their portfolio. But I would say that have you well and truly figured out your digital strategy? You've built a wonderful plan and you know that you are going to be generating delirious sums because you're going to refashion all of your media channels to become e-commerce, great. But I think we also know, one only had to sort of read all of the tales of Net-a-Porter this week and what happened with the Richemont and Yuke's deal. And you actually see that the valuations were pretty big, but actually the revenues fine, but was the profit there? And I think a number of people are still struggling in this territory. And I think media companies need to really move forward with caution.
Tyler in Tokyo, thanks for being with us. Andrew Tuck, Monocle's editor here in studio. Thank you both for being on The Stack. You're listening to The Stack on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. It was a sad week for fans of pioneering Australian title Clio. It stormed the local publishing scene back in 1972 when, with the backing of powerful media magnate Kerry Packer, a young Ita Buttrose planted the idea of blending intelligent commentary surrounding important issues with fashion and lifestyle topics. Just a few years into the magazine's run, in 1975, Ita appeared on the ABC's This Day Tonight programme explaining the magazine's editorial approach, ahead of her transition to becoming editor of the Australian Women's Weekly. Here she explains why she wouldn't put a Clio model on the front of the long-running women's staple.
Blue. Put that cover on Women's Weekly.
No, I don't think I would. She might be... She's the wrong image, I think. That's a very clear colour, and the Woman's Weekly has another image again, perhaps a slightly softer image, and one would look for that. It also has a news image, and one would be looking for news covers and news pictures that would fit in with its format of being a news colour magazine.
Maybe she'd be wearing more on a Woman's Weekly cover too.
The Woman's Weekly, I'm sure, doesn't mind if girls wear bikinis.
What do you think the image of the Woman's Weekly is?
It's a very trusted... magazine. It's a friend. I think the Woman's Weekly is a friend.
Well, some years later, in 2013, Ita Buttrose said she knew the end was in sight for Clio when the team was merged with youth title Dolly. Here she is speaking on Australia's Channel 10.
Where the magazines are failing is that they're dishing up dreary content and they haven't kept pace with women who are better educated and more discerning in what they want to read. You can entertain people with your magazine. Mm. You can put gossip in there. But for God's sake, put some issues in there that are well worth reading. There's plenty to discuss.
But of course, the business of fashion is, by its very nature, fleeting and always subject to tidal changes. So how can today's publications avoid the pitfalls that Clio couldn't and stay relevant? I'm joined now by Monocle's fashion and luxury expert, Sagra Masira de Rosen. Sagra, thanks very much for being with us. It's always good to hear from you. Maybe start with a bit of an overview of the fashion publishing space, I guess. Is this a corner? We talk a lot about the health of the magazine market. Mm. What's the health? How would you assess it of the fashion space? Is it an area where there's lots of confusion about the roles that fashion titles need to play? Is it an area that's dealing well with the challenge of digital? How would you characterise it at the moment?
Well, I think it is a space that is mostly dominated by global titles. If you look at, from Vogue to Marie Claire to Elle, these are franchises that are all over the world. So I think that's one of the key things to think about. I also think that you're right. I think that there is so much content being created today in the fashion world by the users of fashion that many of these fashion titles are trying to find their place in this mm-hmm. landscape. And whether it's taking an editorial standpoint or whether it's broadening their reach from just fashion to lifestyle, health, beauty, which are well-being, which are themes that are more and more important, you're starting to see how each of the titles is kind of starting to move in one direction.
I mean, that's really interesting. And I wonder whether there's a sort of a fundamental change here in terms of the role that fashion titles play. We were talking to Tyler and Andrew earlier in the programme about exactly these sorts of challenges. Is one of the issues that the whole media around fashion is so much more immediate now? It used to be that the great editors, the great magazines were the conduit for consumers. The trade side of things happened, they interpreted it, they told people what they needed to know, and maybe that role has changed somewhat. Do you think maybe some of the titles that are struggling have been slow to realise that there's been that fundamental change?
Absolutely. I think the fundamental change in media in general is towards the digital format, and the ways that people consume media today are very, very different. And only, you know, even the stronger franchises, I think they are struggling with that, mostly because they have been created for print and extended with more or less success into the digital world. But in terms of the role of fashion magazines today, I think there is still play a very important role, because, and I do see this abundance of information and imagery created by, you know, by users, by bloggers, by photographers, by everybody today, as an opportunity to really establish an editorial point of view and to cut through all that information and kind of fashion noise into something that is, you know, useful to the reader and to the media customer.
Do you think that's maybe why there's a bit of a race to this sort of premium space? People often talk about that quite glibly, but in fact, it's because, you know, brands, you understand both sides of this equation. Lots of the big luxury brands, they still value, and there is a tremendous premium for which they're willing to pay. The key names, you know.
Absolutely.
Vogue still matters.
Absolutely.
More than that kind of white noise you're talking about.
Well, I tell you something. I think that we're starting to see today some studies on the impact and the effectiveness of digital advertising. Right, for the last few years, it has been such a rush towards digital advertising that it has been in a way a self-fulfilling prophecy. Right, but now we're starting to see some proper analysis and proper studies of the effectiveness. And I think that we're going to go back to the fact that traditional print media advertising is still incredibly powerful with very important consumer set, particularly for fashion, luxury goods, and you know, upmarket goods. I think that that's what's going to make many of these magazines is still very, very relevant in the years to come. I don't think they're going to disappear.
It's interesting you say that, Zagra, and I think we were hearing earlier in the show from Australia about the demise of Clio magazine, and looking at a recent front cover of that,
yes,
you realise it almost looks like a distilled web page. There's lots of little bitty pieces of information.
Yeah.
Is that one problem that editors, you know, editors who maybe don't have that grasp of what their title is about, are almost sort of thrown into this existential panic by the digital space, and so they try and weirdly incorporate online elements into their into their hard copy process, and it just doesn't work.
It doesn't work. I think that it's like any other industry to a certain degree. You know, the good titles, the good things don't go away because they have either they stay true to their principles and therefore continue to be relevant, or they evolve with society and with the changes that are necessary. Are only the businesses that, you know, their time has come cease to exist, and that's not just in publishing. I mean, I don't see amazing magazines going out of print. You know, I see magazines that are irrelevant to a certain degree, or they have like such a small readership and no strong point of view that they don't make the cut. But I don't see a strong magazine. And on the other hand, I also see new magazines coming up that are incredibly beautiful. So I do think that, let's just call it the move towards a premium positioning or a luxury positioning, is something that will happen more and more, and magazines will become more beautiful as opposed to things that you just kind of buy and throw away.
Yeah, the sort of generic glossies. What's interesting, I mean, we start off by talking about the big international franchises. They're so dominant and they shape so much of the market, not just because of the content that they're producing, but because others seek to try and replicate their successes. Again, Tyler was talking at the top of the show about some niche titles, much smaller, little independents perhaps, that really understand a very specific area. Do you think as we look at the coverage of fashion in media more generally, we maybe need to accept that that's the way it might go. A few huge international players, and then the really creative thinking happening. But absolutely, it will be by definition from smaller independents who have that understanding.
Absolutely. I think that's clearly the case in fashion publishing as well. And I think there is room for something else, for the local title, the domestic title. For example, you know, you see in countries like Spain, you have like a magazine like Telva, right, which is like the domestic fashion lifestyle magazine. So that still has a space because it is able to translate global fashion trends into the idiosyncrasies of a market, right? Or Yodona in Italy, or I don't know, Numero L'Officiale in France. I think the local fashion magazines still have a place as well in the publishing landscape.
And a final thought: you're still confident that we talked about that sort of white noise of the bloggers and vloggers and all these things. I don't really understand them, Sagra, I'll be honest. You're still confident that the editorial voices that speak with real clarity, their appeal is enduring, and they'll be heard even over all of that other commotion.
You know, I think that absolutely yes. The same way that those voices from the digital space that are clear and have a strong point of view will also be heard, and very successfully so. And they could even translate into a print magazine. You know, I think we're seeing more and more the confluence of models, you know, in retail, for example, like online retailers starting to launch physical stores to have that experience as well. So why not? I mean, I think that a digital magazine could potentially translate into a physical. Maybe Porter magazine is an example of something that kind of maybe came out of a digital online business.
We'll watch the space with interest.
Absolutely.
That's Monocle's fashion and luxury expert Sagra Masira de Rosen here on The Stack. And that is just about all we have time for on this week's programme. Thanks to our producer, Ben Ryland, researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and editor this week, Toby Hammond. If you have any comments or queries, drop us a note at info@monocle.com. Don't forget to tune in at the same time next Saturday for the next edition. You can always catch up if you've missed some of this show, or indeed delve into the archive of past editions at monocle.com or via iTunes. This has been The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Thanks for listening.